Headlines this hour, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani once again criticizes the U.S. for hindering the country's efforts to buy coronavirus vaccines. Millions of Americans lose their jobless benefits as U.S. President Donald Trump refuses to sign a coronavirus relief bill into law. And officials in Indian-controlled Kashmir say that New Delhi has arrested at least 75 Kashmiri political leaders and activists following the recent local elections there. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has lashed out at the U.S. for hindering the country's efforts to buy coronavirus vaccines. Rouhani said that the U.S. has caused trouble for Iran to acquire vaccines through what he called wicked activities. He said that Iran will do its utmost to obtain an effective and reliable vaccine despite American sanctions. The president assured that Iran has installed the proper equipment to store any type of COVID-19 vaccine. Tehran has time and again complained that U.S. financial sanctions are blocking its access to drug and medical supplies. International lawyer Barry Grossman says that the U.S. has made no effort to facilitate Iran's access to medicines and humanitarian goods.
The problem, of course, is while they pay lip service not embargoing the sale of humanitarian goods to Iran, they've made no effort to facilitate the financial transactions that go with the acquisition of such products, be it medicine or other humanitarian goods. And therefore, it's virtually impossible for Iran to purchase what is needed in a timely manner. And it's worth remembering that it was only late in 2018, October of 2018, that the International Court of Justice ordered the U.S. To lift the sanctions insofar as it restricted Iran's ability to acquire humanitarian goods, medicines, and products relating to the aviation industry. The U.S. response to that was to give notice to withdraw from the treaty. But we come back to the problem at hand, and it's very interesting. We often hear the United States trying to explain its hostile position to Iran as an attempt to what the U.S. would call liberate Iranians from an oppressive regime, which is, of course, nonsense. But this action shows this contempt for the health and well-being and the very lives of the most vulnerable in Iranian society shows that the U.S. couldn't care less about the Iranian people.
The number of deaths from the coronavirus has surpassed 190,000 in Brazil as the fast-spreading disease continues to rage across the country. The Brazil Health Ministry reported near 500 fatalities and nearly 23,000 new cases on Saturday. Brazil has over 7.4 million infections. In Mexico, more than 9,600 people contracted the virus in the last 24 hours. It also registered more than 665 new fatalities, pushing the overall death toll to nearly 122,000. Mexico has already started mass coronavirus vaccination, along with several other Latin American countries. In the U.S., the number of fatalities has surpassed 330,000, while its total cases are nearing 19 million. The U.S. remains the world's worst hit country by the pandemic. U.S. police say that they have found possible human remains near the site of a huge blast that tore through the city of Nashville, Tennessee on Friday. Drake said the origin of the tissue remains unclear and that there were no confirmed fatalities. He added that a possible motive for the blast was unknown. Three people suffered minor injuries after a parked motorhome in downtown Nashville exploded at dawn. The blast came just moments after officers responded to reports of gunfire in the area and discovered a recreational vehicle. Police said the explosion appeared to be an intentional act. Millions of Americans have lost their jobless benefits amid U.S. President Donald Trump's refusal to sign a coronavirus relief bill into law. Trump urged U.S. lawmakers to make a number of changes to the measure, including bigger direct payments to families and individuals. He criticized the bill for offering too much money to special interests, cultural projects, and foreign aid. The U.S. Labor Department says Trump's rejection of the bill would leave nearly 14 million Americans without unemployment benefits. The move can also result in a partial government shutdown next week. Lawmakers agreed on a $2.3 trillion pandemic aid and spending package last week after months of wrangling. In the U.S., record levels of Americans are struggling with unemployment after they lost their jobs due to the outbreak of the coronavirus. British think tank says China will overtake the U.S. as the world's biggest economy by 2028 after outperforming its rival during the COVID-19 pandemic. The Center for Economics and Business Research said in its annual report that the pandemic and its economic fallout have changed the rivalry in favor of China. The U.S. is the worst hit country by COVID-19 in terms of both deaths and infections. The UK-based consultancy group said that China has skillfully managed the coronavirus pandemic with its strict early lockdown, said that Beijing bounced back quickly from the effects of COVID-19 and would grow by 5.7% a year from 2021 to 2025, before slowing down to 4.5% a year from 2026 to 2030. Author and columnist Anar Tangen says that China is economically more strong to make up for its lost revenues from imports after the U.S. boycotted Chinese products.
Right now, with these tech wars, they're simply pushing China to be less reliant on the U.S., therefore buying less U.S. products. Who is that hurting? It's not hurting China. China will emerge from it with their own independent IP, and they'll continue to produce. Yeah, unfortunately, the U.S., many of the firms there will start shedding employees, and these are high-paying employees, which are going to continue to go down. Donald Trump chose to politicize what is, in essence, a medical scientific issue. China, in essence, followed its scientists. It did. At the time, remember, we go back 9 months, people were complaining that China was taking draconian measures, and they were being criticized widely across the world for imposing this lockdown. But it turns out that this was really the only way to do it. Now, one of the big issues, which for some reason no one is willing to talk about, is tracing. Right now, if you're tracing in China, they do it automatically. You have, anytime you go into an establishment, even your home apartment base, you will be scanned.
The Indian government has detained at least 75 Kashmiri political leaders and activists after an alliance of regional political parties won the first ever local election there. Police officials said the detentions were for preventive custody and included pro-independence leaders and members of a banned outfit. The arrest followed the conclusion of district council elections this week. The vote was won by an alliance formed by two former state chief ministers, Omar Abdullah and Mehbooba Mufti. The two leaders are fighting for peaceful restoration of Kashmir's autonomy, which the ruling right-wing Indian government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi revoked last year. Since then, the disputed Himalayan region has been under crippling lockdown. The Israeli regime has carried out fresh airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, targeting several areas of the besieged Palestinian coastal enclave. In a statement, the Israeli military said that its warplanes hit three Hamas targets early Saturday, claimed that the airstrikes were in response to rockets fired from Gaza. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas denounced the attacks, which targeted a children's hospital and also a rehabilitation center there. It underlined that such moves would not break the Palestinians' will, but rather strengthen their resistance and resolve to fight for their legitimate rights. The Israeli regime often targets the Gaza Strip, citing similar accusations. Earlier, correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, gave us more details on the Israeli attacks.
Israeli fighter jets attacked central Gaza and also the eastern part of Gaza City. During this airstrike, Israeli fighter jets damaged the children's hospital and also damaged a center that treats the disabled. At least one child was injured. Israeli fighter jets used at least six rockets against the Gaza Strip and also used artillery fire to attack areas in the east of Deir al-Balah. This has been a grim reminder to people of Gaza of the 2008 war. Around this time, 2008, Israel waged a 22-day war on Gaza, killing and maiming hundreds of people in the tiny enclave. Since then, Israel waged two more wars and caused huge destruction, a huge loss of life for nearly 2 million people in the Gaza Strip.
The Syrian Foreign Ministry has slammed Israel's latest attack on the country, saying that such acts of aggression will not go without consequences. The remarks came in a letter sent to the UN Secretary General and the President of the UN Security Council in reaction to Israel's Friday airstrikes in Hama countryside. The letter stressed that continuous support from the U.S. and some members of the Council has encouraged Israel to push ahead with this aggressive approach. Damascus condemned Israel's attacks as a flagrant violation of U.S. Security Council resolutions. It also called on the Council to assume its responsibility in preventing Israeli attacks. Meanwhile, Russia criticized Israel's airstrikes on Syria, saying that such actions, quote, further destabilize the complicated regional situation. Political commentator Michael Springman says that the UN remains silent despite Israel's continued aggression.
It's another outrage committed by the apartheid entity that calls itself Israel, and it's done only because the United States supports that illegitimate entity, and the United Nations, which in by and large is the creature of the United States, will take no action because it fears American pressure, it fears loss of money from the United States, and because the United States is a permanent member of the Security Council and can block any kind of resolution. It's unconscionable. The Israelis flew over Beirut in Lebanon, striking at Syria, claiming they were attacking, depending on which Israeli newspaper you read, the weapons production facility in Syria, or they were attacking Iran-supported military groups in the area. Christmas Eve attacks, of course, it's a there are a number of Christians in Lebanon and in Syria, and it's a time for them of preparing for a great feast day, and they were scared out of their wits by the low-flying jets and the huge explosions.
The first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's anti-terror icon, General Qasem Soleimani, along with senior Iraqi military commander Abu Mahdi Mohandas, is just around the corner. Our correspondent has talked to a number of Iraqi people about the assassination.
Martyrs Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Mohandas played a pivotal role in eliminating terrorist groups, including Daesh. They were always present on the ground, briefed troops, and provided them with weapons and equipment. As you saw, great martyr Qasem Soleimani went to the battleground in person and led combats. His companion Abu Mahdi Mohandas was present too. These two great men were role models.
The two martyrs, General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas, were the real reason behind Iraq's victory against terrorist groups. We shouldn't forget their efforts to extricate Iraq from the clutches of terrorists and making the Iraqi people united against them. These two men were the real contributors to the defeat of terrorists. We shouldn't forget that they adopted great, brave, and supportive positions, not only on Iraq, but on the entire region and the world.
General Qasem Soleimani foiled enemy plots with his experience and by being present on the ground in the entire region. The United States was seeking revenge on the person who had thwarted those conspiracies, especially with regard to the Daesh terrorist group. So Washington committed a heinous crime by assassinating Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Mohandas. The crime was justified by reasons bearing no reality and was condemned by human rights groups and peace-loving countries.
One day, Iraq was overrun by the Daesh terrorist group and no country stood by Iraq except Iran. Qasem Soleimani, accompanied by a high-ranking delegation, traveled to Iraq and brought with him the necessary weapons and equipment to save Iraq. Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Mohandas were the two leaders of victory over Daesh. They rid not only Iraq and Iraqis, but the world and its people of terrorism. This irritated the U.S., which had supported terrorism for years. So the U.S. decided to get rid of the leaders of victory and assassinated them in Baghdad, which was a horrific crime.
Abu Mahdi Mohandas and Qasem Soleimani played a key role in backing the Islamic resistance and movement to support the oppressed all around the world. Those resisting enemies in Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine knew them very well. Their martyrdom played an important role. These two martyrs had gone through formidable battles during their lifetime, and their martyrdom served as a tough fight against hegemonic powers too. But their assassination enraged many people around the world who all condemned the United States' criminal acts.
The humanitarian disaster in Yemen grinds on, with people grappling with unending airstrikes, hunger, and deadly diseases. Yemeni children have been hit particularly hard by the war and its consequences.
Yemen is currently the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Yemeni people are facing a long list of unbearable problems, such as daily airstrikes, famine-like conditions, different deadly diseases, and an economy in tatters. Meanwhile, Yemeni children are undoubtedly the most vulnerable part of the population. The situation of children in Yemen has been described as a crisis within a broader humanitarian catastrophe. This week, Yemen's health minister once again raised the alarm about the situation of children in his country. Taha al-Mutawakkili said 3,800 children have been killed in attacks carried out by the Saudis and their allies over the past years. He also warned that the aggressors' bombardment campaign has devastated Yemen's health infrastructure, making it increasingly difficult to save children. The plight of the Yemeni kids has once again come under the spotlight just a few months before the 6th anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi-led military offensive against Yemen. Earlier this month, the United Nations Children's Fund said one Yemeni child dies every 10 minutes from a preventable disease, 2 million are out of school, and thousands have been killed or maimed since 2015. The United Nations has been quite loud in voicing concern about the ongoing crisis, but it is also under fire for removing the Saudi-led coalition this year from a blacklist of child killers. The Saudi-led alliance was first blacklisted several years ago for killing and injuring children in the war.
The United Nations, of course, has this endemic weakness, I dare say, being that it's an organization that for a big part is dependent on the world superpowers to really take action. And we have seen in the past that for this reason, it is very difficult sometimes for the United Nations to really come into action, even when a lot of the member states might want to. We have enormous pressure from Saudi Arabia.
And that is World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 12, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participants at the joint graduation ceremony held at the Imam Ali Military Academy.
The third point is that despite the foolish desires of the prattling, despicable, treacherous, and criminal U.S. officials, we will overcome problems with the power of faith and national determination, and we will improve our conditions, God willing. We will use the very same sanctions to make our country resistant. In other words, the sanctions will make our country resistant, and we'll be able to create an economy of resistance in the true sense of the word. I have said this many times, and I wish to repeat it so that activists in different areas, both economic and non-economic, know that the cure for all problems exists inside the country. Many of our problems originate from outside the country, but the cure for them exists inside the country. No one should seek the cure for problems outside the country. We will not receive any good thing from outside the country. The cure exists in the country.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need, my Lord. dishonor brought me faith to be stronger.
Cure is domestic acumen and domestic endeavor. The cure lies in adopting the correct outlook and calculations towards the domestic and regional issues of the country, and this should be done inside the country. We should do so by utilizing the power of wisdom and by benefiting from firm determination. It is quite possible to overcome problems. God willing, and the prattle and nonsensical words uttered by the thugs dominating the U.S. nation should not occupy anyone's mind. Well, let us return to the subject of the armed forces. I wish to offer some recommendations. One recommendation is about the academies. One important task is that we should know that threats against countries, both against our country and against others, are constantly changing. What exists as a military threat today was not necessarily considered as a threat 20 years ago.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Africa Today.
Iranians have a long history of ties with the East African coasts. The most significant aspect of these relations is the immigration of a group of Iranians from Shiraz to the coasts and islands of East Africa about 1,000 years ago.
The main substantial explanation comes from the Kilwa Chronicles. One important information that comes from this Portuguese chronicle is that the people who came, they were Iranians. That is very clear because it says that they are from Shiraz, led by Ali bin Hassan.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenyam, and welcome to this edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on the historical immigration of Shirazis from Iran to the East African coasts. We shall briefly look at how this movement influenced the formation of the Swahili culture and civilization. We are also asking what efforts are being made to preserve this tangible heritage. And as you watch, let us know what you think by sending us your views and comments through our email handle, and stay tuned till the end.
Iranian immigrants in East Africa. African traditional history recognizes early connections with the Persian Gulf. The most pervasive are stories of origin from Shiraz. Historical accounts tell of the voyage of seven ships manned by a father who left Shiraz with his six sons for East Africa. He later established permanent settlements across a vast region of the eastern coast of Africa.
These Iranians from Shiraz had deep and long-standing social and cultural impacts on indigenous people of East and Southern East African coasts. Many elements of Iranian culture and civilization are still visible in parts of today's Somalia, Kenya, Tanzania, Mozambique, and the Comoros.
The cultural heritage of Shirazis who settled in East Africa include the celebration of Nowruz, prevalence of Iranian architecture, and the massive influence of Persian in Kiswahili, the main language spoken by East Africans. To discuss the historical immigration of Shirazis from Iran to East Africa, we are joined here in the studio by Professor Amir Bahram Arab Ahmadi. He's a historian and the head of the Central and Southern Africa Studies Department at the University of Tehran. Also joining us from Tanzania is Professor Abdul Sharif of Zanzibar. Professor Abdul Sharif's current research interests is on the history of Zanzibar, the Swahili coast, and the Indian Ocean. We start off with Professor Arab Ahmadi. Thanks a lot for joining us today in our program.
Thank you very much. This is a great pleasure of mine to be with you in this program for some minutes.
We're also happy to host you. Now, to start off, Professor Arab Ahmadi, now, can you tell us briefly about the immigration of Iranians to East Africa, particularly the Shirazis?
Yes, of course, before migration of Shirazis to East Africa, which resulted to permanent settlements of them in that part of Africa, for quite a number of centuries. We have had some other historical contact between Iran and East Africa, which goes back to ancient era, to actually the time of Achaemenid dynasty and Sassanids.
Okay.
But talking about migration of Shirazis to East African coast, which can be considered as one of the most historical events which has happened between Iran and East Africa in particular. Very briefly, I can tell you this historical migration has been taking place in 10th century during the time of Ali Buya dynasty in Iran, in some part of Iran. Under the leadership of someone known as Prince Ali ibn Hassan Shirazi, who was then governor of Fars province.
Yeah.
And of course, Shiraz was the capital of Fars province. They migrated to East African coast and settled in a narrow area from today's southern shores of Somali right up to northern today's Mozambique, including today's Kenya, of course, coastal area and islands only. Today's Kenya, Tanzania, Zanzibar archipelago, as well as Comoros archipelago. Yeah, and they made, as I mentioned, and you mentioned too, they established permanent settlement in quite number of islands and coastal area, something between 50 up to 80 location.
Thank you very much, Professor Arab Ahmadi, for that concise introduction. Now, the Swahili language obtained many vocabularies from Persian language. Persian poets influenced the Swahili literature through their classic works. The influence of Persian architecture is seen in Shirazi building style throughout East African coastal towns, including Lamu. Actually, Lamu is the oldest and best preserved Swahili settlement in East Africa. The influence of Persian architecture is also clearly visible in former Swahili city-states, including Mombasa, Zanzibar, and Kilwa. Founded in the 40th century, the Great Mosque of Kilwa was one of the major Persian heritage sites in Tanzania.
Two important structures dating from this era still stand. The first is the Great Mosque, which was built in the 14th century and was once the largest mosque in sub-Saharan Africa. The other is the Palace of Husuni Kubwa, built between 1315 and 1330 and renowned for its spectacular pools and courtyards.
Now let's bring in Professor Abdul Sharif of Zanzibar. Thank you for your time, Professor Abdul Sharif. We have heard from Dr. Arab Ahmadi here how Shirazis moved to East Africa. Now, do we still have ethnic Iranian Shirazis in East Africa?
When they came to East Africa, they intermarried with the local people. And in fact, we have one of the oldest traditions, the Kilwa tradition, a chronicle in which it says that Hassan bin Ali, the person who came so many centuries ago, married the daughter of the local chief. And therefore, his children then became legitimate from his side as well as from the mother's side. So what we should expect is not to find community of Persian-looking people now remaining exclusive somewhere. They have intermarried for 1,000 years now. And so you'll find them from brown to black. But you ask them, what is your origin? They'll say, we are Shirazi. And they will recount their history. So in that sense, they are Shirazi, not racially, but because they have been mixed for 1,000 years.
Thank you for that, Professor Abdul Sharif, leading historian and researcher in Tanzania.
The Shirazis brought Persian traditions and customs to East Africa. They also intermarried with the local communities. Kiswahili, the language of the East African coastal regions, contains many Persian loan words. The Kiswahili language is now not just confined to East Africa after being declared an official language of the African Union.
And now we are back to the studio with our guest, Professor Arab Ahmadi. Can you elaborate to us on how the Shirazis impacted on the culture of East Africans?
Yeah, this is a very deep question and, of course, should have an extensive answer.
Yeah.
To be honest, due to long-standing settlement of Shirazis in East African coast and island, approximately 500 years, and of course since they established a very friendly relation with indigenous people of East African coast through intermarriage and of course based on equality, which was very very important for Africans, they transferred either directly or indirectly some part of Iranian culture and of course customs to East African indigenous people.
Okay.
For example, they have been very influential for enrichment of Kiswahili language.
Yeah.
Right now, there have been more than 500 Persian words which have been inherited and now used in day-to-day interaction by Swahili-speaking people, either those who, Swahili language is considered as their first language or second language, no different. And, you know, this reality has been recognized by Swahili Academy of Kenya and Tanzania.
Yeah.
Apart from Persian words, we will see strong traces of Persian or Farsi literature on Swahili literature. Some great Iranian poets such as Sa'di, Ferdowsi, Khayyam, and Hafez have been influential, of course, indirectly to Swahili culture and Swahili literature. If we have a look at, for example, Utenzi, or for example, Fiumu Lungu legend, or Inkishafi, we will see a type of inspiration that those who made such this legend and books have received from Iranian literature. And of course, definitely, Shirazi had been actually link of, you know, this cultural and literary proximity.
Professor Arab Ahmadi, can you briefly also elaborate on the impact of Shirazi architecture, especially in the construction of mosques in East Africa?
Yes, thank you very much. Very good question. We will see the deep influences of Shirazis in East African coast in particular, in the form of construction of mosques,
yeah,
and of course stone building. For example, if we have a look to Kilwagan Mosque,
yeah,
or Hosni Kubra Palace,
yeah,
or Hosni Endogo,
yeah,
or some mausoleum attribute to Shirazi kings,
yeah,
we will see exactly the presence and prevalence of Iranian architectural,
yeah,
style. For example, in terms of arc, which mm-hmm. has been used, for example, columns,
yeah,
bricks, for example, domes,
yeah,
that for the first time was used in the history of East African coast, and of course installation of long columns on the top of some mausoleums,
yeah,
all are representing the existence of Iranian architectural style.
Thanks a lot. Actually, there's a lot more to discuss on this topic. Now, we're also going to get some comments from Professor Abdul Sharif of Zanzibar on how Shirazis contributed to the culture and civilization of East Africa.
Went further specifically to be Iranian. They seem to have probably introduced Farsi words, for example, in Kiswahili, there was in Kiswahili, which are very distinctly Persian rather than Arabic. We have the word in Kiswahili for factories is karkhana, which is obviously Farsi.
Iranian immigrants in East Africa.
Back to the studio here with our guest, Professor Arab Ahmadi. Now, you've lived in Tanzania for some years, and you witnessed the Mwaka Kogwa celebration in Zanzibar. How similar is it to the Nowruz here in Iran?
Yeah, I do remember when I was in Tanzania, I had a chance once to actually participate in Mwaka Kogwa festival, which used to held every year,
yeah,
in a certain township known as Makontochi. During that day, a lot of people are coming, not mm-hmm. only from Zanzibar, but also from Kenya and
yeah.
Tanzania to watch it. Of course, answering to first part of your question, as I mentioned, celebration of Nowruz,
yeah,
which means a new day, and we actually celebrate it at mm-hmm. the beginning of new Iranian year or new solar year.
Yeah.
Was introduced by Shirazis to indigenous people of East African coast and island, and
yeah.
was accepted by them. And they kept it and preserved it as a part of their own tradition, even after eradication of Shirazi kingdom.
Yeah.
They kept it and preserved it.
Yeah.
And of course, they continue to celebrate it year after year until now.
Okay.
But to be honest, the Nowruz celebration that we are celebrating in Iran is, to some extent, different from Mwaka Kogwa.
Yeah.
Almost 50% of Iranian Nowruz celebration is intact, whilst from African side, they have entered some part of their own culture,
yeah, local cultures,
tradition,
yeah,
which they have inherited from their ancestors.
Now let's take a look at Mwaka Kogwa celebrations in Zanzibar.
This is only the beginning of Mwaka Kogwa ceremony. On the day of the ceremony, thousands of Zanzibari people, together with tourists and reporters from around the world, would flock to the main square of Makunduchi to watch the Mwaka Kogwa, an event which is more of a fight.
Two young men from northern part of Makunduchi and two other from southern part fight using banana stems as fighting weapons. Young people from both parts of the village, along with the women, make a circle around the fighters and start singing different local songs about love and the like. Either side of the combat who feels the defeat would surrender, otherwise it would continue until one side surrenders.
About three generations ago, stones and cudgels were used as fighting weapons on the Mwaka Kogwa Day. But Karume, the first president of Zanzibar after the revolution, banned the use of stones and cudgels. And banana stems replaced the cudgels to avoid the damage.
Cultural identity is important for people's sense of self and how they relate to others. A strong cultural identity can contribute to people's overall well-being. The interaction with Persians is now part of the lasting heritage of East Africans. What needs to be done to preserve these cultural heritage sites that point to the historical influence of Iranians in East Africa?
There is actually a lot of evidence of Persian connection. All over Zanzibar, in fact, all over East Africa, when you dig in any archaeological site, you find a lot of what are called Sassanid Islamic pottery. Plenty, thousands of pieces of this pottery exist, and they actually give the date of when they were imported into this area, and then, of course, buried in the ground. So all of these heritage sites should be studied by experts who are good archaeologists working with historians to do the history and whatever that has survived to be preserved in a proper way. Like I mentioned the mosque on Tumbatu Island in the north that is in ruins, and even the mihrab had fallen down.
Cultural heritage and natural history of a nation has a very high value and is unique. One of the aspirations contained in the African Union Agenda 2063 is that of an Africa with a strong cultural identity, common heritage, shared values, and ethics. Therefore, preserving the tangible heritage of the Swahili civilization is of great importance to East African countries and the African continent in general. Now, Professor Arab Ahmadi, what measures are being taken to preserve these Shirazi or Persian heritage in Tanzania and East Africa in general? And also, are you in contact with your colleagues, academic colleagues in East Africa in this regard?
Yeah, to be honest, East African people have done the best in order to preserve whatever they have inherited from Shirazis. And they have transferred, such this component as a part of their own oral culture and tradition, generation by generation.
Now, Professor, you've written several books, which you've brought us to us in the studio here. Now, can you elaborate on these books and papers which you've written?
Yeah, I can say, on my own part, I have tried to do whatever I could do. I have traveled several times to Tanzania, Kenya, and Zanzibar, and I have extracted a lot of, I can say, rare and unique information through my field studies. For I have communicated with some ordinary people in the coastline of Tanzania and Kenya, and I have, as I mentioned, I have extracted even some traditions from, I can say, their own hearts.
Yeah,
I
exactly.
have actually talked to them. I have listened, you know, some legend you know, that they have received from their fathers, forefathers. And through this, I have tried to discover some fact which can be considered as, you know, very valuable oral literature involving about the history of Shirazi. These are some of the books, and of course, apart from this book, I have written quite a number of scholarly papers.
Thank you very much, Professor Arab Ahmadi, for your time here and your incisive analysis on the immigration of Shirazis to East Africa. And we look forward to the strengthening of the cultural and historical ties between the people of Iran and East Africa.
Thank you very much. I have to thank you and the organizer and producer of this fruitful program, which gives a lot of information about common history of Iran and East Africa.
Thank you. And that wraps it up for this edition of Africa Today, which focused on the historical ties between Iran and East Africa. We shall continue to bring you more programs on the African cultural and historical heritage in our future shows. Do let us know what you would like to see in our show. Take care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-aliyy al-azim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina abil qasim al-mustafa Muhammad. Wa ala alihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin. La siyama baqiyatillahi fil aradin. Ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-sharif. Wa ja'alana min a'wani wa ansarih. Last night we talked about a very important dimension of balance that must exist in every person and in our community. And that is the balance that we should strike between being emotional and being rational. both, and if we lose one of them or if we overdo one of them, then it creates problem. I mentioned two hadith about the significance of having a kind of emotional unity or connection or link with Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. And now I'm going to share with you the third hadith, which leads us to another characteristic of the community, and that is truthfulness. Amirul Mu'minin alayhi salam, in a famous hadith, said, إن الله تبارك وتعالى أطلع إلى الأرض فاختارنا واختار لنا شيعة. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala looked at the earth, looked at the people, and among them he chose us. And he chose for us some Shia, some followers. يَنْصُرُونَنَا. These are the people that help us. These are the people that work for achieving our goals. Then Amirul Mu'minin said, Al-Mayyatu min Shi'atina Siddiqun Shaheed. If a real Shia, a true follower of us, dies, he dies as a Siddiq, as a person who is truthful. To be Siddiq is very high position. It's so high that even when Allah wants to praise Prophet Ibrahim, he says, وَذْكُرْ فِي الْكِتَابِ إِبْرَاهِيمِ إِنَّهُ كَانَ صَدِّيقًا نَبِيًا. Ibrahim was Siddiq. Lady Maryam was Siddiqa, as Allah says, وَأُمُّهُ Siddiqa. To be Siddiq is very high position. Indeed, one of the four highest categories is to be Siddiq. مَنْ يُتِعَ اللَّهَ وَالرَّسُولِ فَأُولَٰئِكَ مَعَ الَّذِينَ أَنْعَمَ اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِمْ مِنَ النَّبِيِّينَ وَالصَّدِّيقِينَ وَالشُّهَدَاءِ وَالصَّالِحِينَ. So to be a prophet or Siddiq or a witness or righteous. Of course, some people have more than one of them. So Amir al-Mu'minin says, a true Shia, a true follower of us, the one who listens to us and does what we say, avoids all the sins. When he dies as Siddiq, as a truthful person, and Shaheed. Shaheed either means martyr or means a witness. He can be a witness for other people. People can look at him and learn from his or her life. Sadaqa bi amrina. He has been truthful. Not only he accepted our affair, our wilaya. Amr in many hadith means wilaya. Not only he accepted and confirmed our right of wilaya, but also he totally, completely, genuinely tried to act according to wilaya. Just to say, I accept your wilaya is not enough. How much you are ready to change your life, your way of making decisions, your way of making relations according to wilaya? Are you a master yourself, or you are a follower? It's a big question. If we are masters, then we can do whatever we want. But then we cannot call ourselves Shia. We have to change our name. If we are Shia, it means that we have masters, and we want to follow them. Because we know that those masters have their authority from Allah, and they don't want anything for their selfish reasons.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers, open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide,
an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
So a Shia has to be truthful. Inshallah, I will come to this. وَأَحَبَّ فِينَا وَأَبْغَضَ فِينَا. A Shia is the one who loves for our sake and dislikes for our sake. If someone is good with your master, you must not say, I don't like him because he is not very kind to me. No, because he is close to your master, he's good with your master, master loves him, you have to be kind with him, no matter how much personal, you know, relation you have. Or for example, I say, I don't like him because he doesn't speak my language. His face color is not like me. This is not important. Is he close to my master, is a follower of my master or not? If he loves Imam Hussein, that is enough for me. I should love him. We don't have this right to say, I love this person and I don't love that person because of my own selfish reasons. I love him because he comes from the same village that I come. I don't love him because he comes from another village or from another part of the world, or he speaks another language, or he does, for example, azadari in another way, or when there is majlis and they want to give niyaz, you know, we give this niyaz, they give that niyaz. These are not the things that should divide us and keep us separated. If they love Imam Hussein alayhi salam, that's more than enough for me to love them. What greater reason than this you want? Someone is a lover of Hussein. I should do everything to make him or her happy. Because he has the highest quality that I am looking for. It's much more important than color, ethnicity, I don't know which town you come from. As we say in Ziyarat Ashura to Imam Hussein alayhi salam, Ya Aba Abdullah, inni salmun liman salamakum. It's a very important statement, very easy to say, but very difficult to practice. Inni salmun liman salamakum. I think among hundreds of people who are here, I don't want to judge about people, but about myself and people like me, I'm saying we are going to fail in this test. To say to Hussein, honestly, inni salmun liman salamakum. I am at peace with whoever is at peace with you. Even if he has slapped on my face, I am at peace with him. As long as he is doing good to you, maybe he has a personal, maybe he doesn't like me, but I am not going to start fighting him. I don't have any time and energy to spend on personal things. If he is good for you and for your community, I am okay with him. Inni salmun liman salam wa harbun liman harab. Not harbun liman harabani, harbun liman harabakum. Maybe he feels I have killed his father, maybe mistakenly, no problem. As long as he is okay according to your standards, I don't want to have any personal issue with him. I forget everything. It's very difficult. How many people can say this honestly to Imam Hussein? Inni salmun liman salamakum wa harbun liman harabakum. How can Shia take each other to the court? How can Shia, you know, fight with each other? How can Shia damage the reputation of each other?